May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Ian Barney, and I represent the appellant, Blazer Jaworzelewski, along with my co-counsel, Damon Chironis. There's two issues before the court this morning. First, whether the district court improperly applied the abuse of trust enhancement at sentencing. And second, whether the district court improperly construed the sentencing guidelines to be mandatory. Based on these errors, Mr. Jaworzelewski is requesting that this court vacate his sentence and remand the case to the district court for resentencing. Turning to the first issue, under sentencing guideline 3B1.3, a district court may increase defendant's offense level by 2 points if the defendant abused a position of trust in a manner that significantly facilitated the commission or concealment of the offense. Here, the district court erred in applying that enhancement for two reasons. First, Mr. Jaworzelewski did not occupy a position of trust because his position was akin to that of an ordinary bank teller. And second, even if Mr. Jaworzelewski did occupy a position of trust, he did not breach that trust because his position of trust was unrelated to the commission of the offense. Going to the first point, the district court's conclusion that Mr. Jaworzelewski held a position of trust was based on a misinterpretation of 3B1.3, where, namely, the district court essentially concluded that despite the fact that Mr. Jaworzelewski was similarly situated to other employees of the bank, namely ordinary bank tellers, the enhancement nonetheless applied. At sentencing, the government moved for the enhancement based on the following factors. First, that Mr. Jaworzelewski had a key to the front door of the bank. Second, that he had access to the breaker box inside the bank to kill the power. Third, that he had the codes to disarm the exterior and interior alarms. And fourth, that he had one half of the code necessary to open the teller cash dispenser machines. Although Mr. Jaworzelewski certainly concedes that he did possess all of those things, and all of those things are in fact true, so did every other employee at the bank, including every bank teller. Every employee, including every bank teller, had a front door key, had the alarm codes, had access to the breaker box, and had one half of the code necessary to open a teller cash dispenser machine. Every employee, if the court looks to the record, the pre-sentence investigation report on page 5 shows that.
Didn't he have to go one step further to get that TCD code?
TCD.
He had to find another employee's half of the code in order to unlock that?
Your Honor, the government's contention was that he, I believe, found it on the floor at some point. It's not really entirely clear how he came about that the second half of the code. If you believe the government's version that he did find it, that was not part of his responsibilities. He may have, any teller could have found a code, the second half of the code on the floor. The fact that he did is does not put him in a position of trust under 3B1.3.
Why does it make any difference that the tellers had access to the same set of information?
Well, Your Honor, it's important because the enhancement applies, and this court has recognized, where a higher duty exists. In United States v. Fuchs, this court said that in order for the enhancement to apply, a victim must place more than the ordinary degree of reliance on a defendant's integrity and honesty.
Right, but the universe of people that have this highly sensitive security information is sort of beside the point. If he's got this universe of high security information, the fact that others have it as well doesn't make any difference. The fact that he has it and he's trusted with it as a vice president of the bank and assistant manager, and he's responsible for opening and closing, et cetera, and he used that access, the security information, to commit the crime. That's all it takes to get you inside the enhancement.
Your Honor, I disagree with you, and I'd point you to the enhancement itself. In Note 1, the note explicitly states that ordinary bank tellers are not the enhancement does not apply to ordinary bank tellers.
But an ordinary bank teller with all of this high security access code information might well qualify.
The commentary
doesn't categorically exclude all bank tellers. It's a descriptive passage. A teller with this kind of access may well qualify for the abuse of trust.
I would disagree with Your Honor in that the note is pretty clear, and the case law is pretty accepting of the note that it does not apply to ordinary bank tellers.
But if the ordinary bank teller is given the code to deactivate the perimeter and vault alarms and is given, you know, other highly sensitive security information, like half of a code to access the larger amount of cash than is in the teller's drawer, the larger vault, then that bank teller may well qualify. It's not. It's the title is not dispositive.
Your Honor, I agree that the titles are not dispositive, and this Court said they're actually of little value. But that said, this Court has, in fact, looked at various individuals' positions when assessing whether they occupy a position of trust. And it said that the victim needs to place more than the ordinary degree of reliance. Now, the ordinary degree of reliance in this case was that employees were given keys at the front door. They were given the codes to the bank, and they were given one half of the teller cash dispenser code. Now, if every bank in the world followed that same procedure, then note one to the sentence to 3B1.3 would be completely irrelevant.
In the case of these small branches, where you suggest everybody is pretty equal in sense of responsibility, Mr. Barney, are you saying then they're all immunized against the potential for the enhancement? Because let's say in a strip mall, there's five employees that all have this access, so none of them could ever be eligible because they all had the access that Mr. Wasilewski had?
Your Honor, in a sense, that is correct. That's our position, that these individuals are essentially given the base level of trust that this bank can give its employees. And the enhancement, the crime itself would cover their theft then. 18 U.S.C. 656, which is bank theft or embezzlement by a bank employee, covers a breach of trust. This Court has noted that. So an employee who has that information certainly would be breaching the bank's trust. There's no doubt about it. But for the enhancement to apply, there needs to be more. And that's the purpose of the enhancement. It's meant to deter crimes that are difficult to detect, that are hard, that are easy to conceal. For example, the guidelines point to a bank executive's fraud scheme. A bank executive has access to accounts and can move money around without scrutiny. Those crimes are difficult to detect. A bank teller walking into a front door of a bank using his employee key and later leaving it on the counter, using his employee code to undo the alarm, which sends his name to the security company and lets them know that he's the one that deactivated the alarm, and then taking money and walking out the front door, is not the type of crime that 3B1.3 is meant to protect against. That's a crime that's easily solvable. And, in fact, Mr. Wasilewski was caught the very next day. There was really no this was not a crime that was difficult to detect.
Well, yes and no. He was caught at the border. He wasn't caught by bank officials who unraveled the crime. He was able to commit the crime undetected by virtue of his access to all of this code material, all of the security codes that permitted him to, you know, get in after hours in the middle of the night and deactivate all of the security protection at the bank and commit the crime and, you know, make it to the airport to flee the country with the cash.
I understand.
That's when he was discovered by customs in possession of a large amount of cash. So he was able to commit the crime in a concealed way, and it would not have been discovered until he was long gone but for the crack customs officials.
I understand Your Honor's trepidation in that respect, but this was not a man who was fleeing the country. This was a planned vacation with a girlfriend.
He's committing the crime on his way out of town.
I agree, Your Honor. But in addition to that, I see that my time has expired. May I finish answering Your Honor's question?
You're in the rebuttal, but excuse me,
I'm in my rebuttal at this point. I apologize. The FBI, in conjunction with the employees at the bank, solved the crime the next day as well. This was not something that they had any trouble figuring out. It was Mr. Wasilewski. And I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Barney. Ms. Rodney.
May it please the Court. Renee Rodney on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, the District Court did not clearly err by finding that the defendant occupied a position of trust and then abused that position of trust to steal more than $40,000 from the Chase Bank branch. In making this finding, the court correctly found that the defendant was entrusted with, quote, the power and the authority to enter the bank for legitimate purposes and certain tools. And the district court recognized that, while yes, he was entrusted with the key and a PIN number, like some of the other bank tellers might have been, he also recognized his position as assistant bank manager and cited the government's filing, to, which pointed out the ways in which he used that authority to...
What additional duties did he have as the assistant bank manager apart from the ordinary teller?
The defendant was responsible for closing the bank. He was the last person to leave the bank while another person waited in the parking lot. So I believe the inference can be made that he had to activate the alarms and lock the bank door. He also was responsible for overseeing the audit procedures of
could
the
teller. Could he have delegated that to another teller when he's on vacation, for example?
That's not in the record. I'm not sure. We don't have any information.
Well, maybe he's the 24/7, 365 employee, but I suspect that that's not the case. I'm just trying to layer above what all the others do in the bank that he did. Obviously, he doesn't do it anymore.
Yes, the closing procedures.
I understand the title, but I'm right. I'm just trying to see how we're going to separate him from the other employees that Mr. Barney suggests have all the same basic responsibilities, just don't have that title. So I'm trying to find out what's in the title.
Yes, Your Honor. Unlike other employees of the bank, the defendant was entrusted to be the last person in the bank to perform the closing procedures, which I mentioned before.
So he could be about activities that the others could not because they all had to leave in advance of him. Is that the suggestion?
Yes. He was also responsible for the audit procedures, confirming the amounts of money that were in the teller cash dispensers. And he was only assigned one code, but it was the defendant's statement to law enforcement that he found the second half of this code on the floor of the bank. That was not disputed in the district court. That's what's in the record. So as someone who's responsible for the audit procedure who comes across, as the defendant has said, a second code or the second half of the code necessary to access these TCD machines. He didn't alert the bank. He didn't confront the employee whose code it belonged to. He used it to commit his crime by using that second half of the code in conjunction with his own code to open the TCD and steal more than $40,000. The timing of the crime after hours in the middle of the night, hours before his early morning flight to the Dominican Republic, all allowed him to commit the crime without being easily detected.
Mr. Barney had it in brief. He didn't argue it orally. I wonder if you give us the government's position on it. We can be sure that Judge Norgel knew that he was free not to impose the prison sentence.
Well, Your Honor, right when the judge was considering imposing the sentence that he imposed, the court stated, quote, one of the sentences available here was the option provided for under Guideline Section 5C1, Subpart D. In that extended exchange with the probation officer, the judge was simply making sure that the language of the judgment and commitment order read correctly, since what the judge was going to impose would be a term of supervised release that would also include a term of home detention that substituted a portion of the term of imprisonment. So it was a bit tricky. The judge just wanted to make sure that the language was proper. So that was the exchange with the probation officer. When he later makes this comment about steel bars that defense counsel has pointed to you, that was simply followed up by noting that it was the Bureau of Prisons who determines the commitment in this case, whether it's to a high-security institution, I think that's what the judge was referring to when he referenced steel bars, or some lesser form. I think by taking the comments out of context, there might be cause for concern, but if you read the transcript in its entirety, you see that the judge is acknowledging an available sentencing option, one that the defendant himself proposed, and then engaging in an exchange with the probation officer to make sure that the language of the judgment and commitment order properly reflected that sentence. So there's no mistake there that he treated the guidelines as mandatory. What he ultimately ended up doing was imposing a guideline sentence at the low end, and that was supported by the Section 3553A factors.
But the structure of the sentence is kind of unusual because the incarceration time is spread over 6 months imprisonment time followed by 6 months home detention as a condition of supervised release. And that's how I understand the court's colloquy with the probation officer as an attempt to figure out if that's an acceptable way to structure the sentence according to Bureau of Prison Rules.
Right. I think the court was seeking clarification from the probation officer. Is the term of imprisonment, does that start first, or does the period of home detention begin first? And the probation officer clarified that it would be the period of imprisonment followed by a term of supervised release, and it's under that term of supervised release that home detention was ordered by the court.
He's got to be coming to the end of his imprisonment term.
Yes, he was ordered to 6 months imprisonment, and he was remanded on August 31st, so sometime after the new year.
So resentencing could result in the whole 12 months being done behind bars as opposed to half and half?
It is possible that a higher sentence could be posed upon remand.
It's not a higher sentence, or technically.
Or a sentence that doesn't account for home detention, but just 12 months imprisonment, yes. Your Honors, based on the arguments in our briefing and discussed here today, we ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rodney. Mr. Barney?
I'd like to touch on just a few issues very briefly. First, as far as the additional duties that Mr. Wasilewski had as far as audits, overseeing audits, and the bank closing procedures, that's in the government's brief, but that was not evidence presented to the district court. There was the government and the defense relied on the PSR. I would point, Your Honors, to a record at 50 and page 5. There's no evidence that he there was no evidence presented that he oversaw audits or participated in closing procedures as part of his duties, though he did on the night before the theft. Additionally, to speak to the last issue, Judge Norvell, in imposing the sentence, stated that in order to satisfy the law in the first instance, he was committing Mr. Wasilewski to the Bureau of Prisons. He was, of course, referring to 5C1.1D, which recommends a split sentence in certain circumstances. Right after that, he went on to note that this is not the type of case that cries out for 6 months behind bars. That's exactly the sentence that he gave Mr. Wasilewski. It's our position. I see that my time has expired.
Yeah, you can complete the thought.
Your Honor, it's our position that Judge Norville improperly considered 5C1.1D to be mandatory and thus requiring a prison sentence. For that reason and for the other reasons we've stated, we'd be requesting that this court remand the case for resentencing.
Thank you, Mr. Barney. Thank you, Ms. Rodney. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.